We want everyone to succeed, our children to regularly attend school and graduate on time, our families to have financial stability, good housing, and access to health care. At United Way, our work is about empowering people, giving them a hand up, not a hand out. Call us to find out how you can help. 888-3252.
It's time to get the story behind the story. Interviews with newsmakers, newsbreakers, and your phone calls. Radio Vermont presents The Mark Johnson Show.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the program. Thanks for tuning in. It's Friday, and what a gorgeous day out there today. Thanks for spending part of it with us. Coming up on the program this morning, at the bottom of the hour here at 9:30, we're going to head over to Middlebury. We'll be joined by political analyst Eric Davis, get his thoughts, the latest thoughts on the gubernatorial race, a few other items as well, too. Love to take your phone calls during that segment as well as the rest of the program. Here's how you reach us. 244-1777, that's our local number in central Vermont. And you can also reach us on our toll-free lines at 877-291-8255. Speaking of the gubernatorial campaign, we'll talk a little bit about what Scott Milne was up to yesterday, speaking before a high school group. We'll tell you what some of his comments were then. And as I mentioned, we'll take your phone calls throughout the program. Love to hear from you at 244-1777 is our local number. And toll free, you can reach us at 877-291-8255. We're going to begin this morning and talk a little bit about what is the situation going on in Hong Kong these days. Hong Kong returned to Chinese rule back in 1997, and there have been some pretty serious protests that have been going on there. Let's give a nice warm Radio Vermont welcome this morning to Eli Friedman, who teaches at Cornell University, where he's an assistant professor focusing on international and comparative labor. And he recently wrote a piece about this called Why Hong Kong's Occupy Central Movement Has Beijing Very, Very Scared. But really the reason that we have Eli on the program is that he spent some time in East Montpelier. Eli, good morning. How's it going?
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
How'd you wind up going from East Montpelier to Cornell? What's the line there?
Well, I grew up in East Montpelier. I went to U32 High School there. Ended up going to graduate school at the University of California, Berkeley, and then came back to Ithaca, New York.
How long have you been at Cornell?
This is the beginning of my fourth year there.
And you teach international and comparative labor. How many people are taking that course?
Cornell is sort of a unique place. They have something called the School of Industrial and Labor Relations, which was started back in 1945. They have an expertise in labor relations, mostly in the United States, but like many organizations, they are going global, and so they wanted to have some expertise on China. So I actually have pretty good enrollment in my courses.
Mm-hmm. So how familiar are you with China, Hong Kong, with those two places?
Quite familiar. The first time I went to both Hong Kong and China was back in 1999, and since then I've been going pretty regularly. I've probably spent more than 4 years altogether in China, and this is what I do for my research, so now I go probably twice a year and continue to do field work.
Who are the protesters in Hong Kong?
It's a pretty diverse group of people. The people that have been getting the most attention, I think, are the students. There's two major student groups, the Hong Kong Federation of Students, which represents university students, and then a group called Scholarism, which represents high school students. And they've certainly been mobilizing a lot, but it is a more diverse group of people as well. You have middle-class people in the sort of pro-democracy movement that have been organizing for a long time. You also have more working-class people, particularly in a new occupation, which just started in Kowloon District, and some unions that have joined in as well. So it really is a pretty diverse group of people.
What are they fighting for?
Well, the initial demand was for real electoral democracy. Now, Beijing promised Hong Kong that they were going to have universal suffrage for chief executive in 2017. Chief executive is the top elected office in Hong Kong. What Beijing decided this meant was that first candidates would be selected by a committee, which is largely composed of people who are pro-Beijing. This committee would then select two or three candidates, and then everybody in Hong Kong could vote on those two or three candidates. And a lot of people were pretty outraged by this, saying, well, if we don't get to decide who the candidates are, then this is a fake election. So their primary demand initially was for what they're calling civic nomination, which means that anybody can be nominated to stand for election for chief executive. And they've added to that more recently a new demand, which is that they want the current chief executive, a guy named C.Y. Leung, to step down.
This committee, though, is pretty big. It wasn't like it was five people or something.
That's right. It consists of 1,200 people, and it's a mixture. But it's most the people are appointed to the committee, and they're supposed to represent diverse interests within Hong Kong. But the majority of people on the committee are economic and political elites, which have been selected by Beijing for their loyalty. So I think there's real reason to question to what extent this committee is an accurate representation of Hong Kong society.
If the elections that we're talking about were in 2017, why are the protests happening now?
Well, because the decision was just rendered by the National People's Congress in Beijing that this was going to be the electoral procedure. So as soon as the decision came down, then people mobilized. And this decision had been expected for a while, and there's been this group, Occupy Central, has been threatening for a while, for more than a year now, that if the decision does not reflect their idea of democracy, that they're going to occupy streets in central Hong Kong and disrupt business. So this has been a long time coming.
Okay. So this was really triggered by this decision on the nominating process.
That's right.
What are the areas that we're talking about in this Occupy movement?
You mean the areas within Hong Kong that are being occupied?
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting. Initially, they said we're going to occupy Central, which is, again, the Central Business District. At the moment, that area is actually not being occupied. There's two places on Hong Kong Island, which is the sort of more densely populated part. You could sort of think of it as the Manhattan of Hong Kong. There's one area around the main government offices in Admiralty, and then there's another area called Causeway Bay, which is a big shopping area. And then across the harbor in Kowloon, there are two areas which are being occupied. One is Tsim Sha Tsui, which is another shopping area and where there's a lot of tourists, and particularly a lot of tourists that come from mainland China. And then to the north of that is a more working-class neighborhood called Mong Kok, and that is a major occupation site now, and just last night has been the site of some renewed conflict.
Right. Yeah, I mean, this is really getting to a different level here. So describe what happened last night between the pro-Beijing demonstrators and the Occupy protesters.
So last night in Mong Kok, which is an area that is, again, it's more working class. There's also a heavy triad or organized crime presence in the area. People have been very peacefully and very orderly occupying this public space, and indeed they are causing disruptions. And some small business owners have expressed concern about the fact that it's affecting their business. So, it's generating tensions. But what happened last night is groups of these people went down and began physically attacking the encampment and destroying some of the things that people set up and hitting some people, throwing water bottles, things like that. So this is certainly an escalation and different than the kinds of police violence that we saw earlier in the occupations.
The initial response of the government seemed to be basically to try to ignore it. Is that fair to say?
To ignore this new round of violence?
Well, no, the protests initially, the Occupy movement initially, and kind of just hope it would go away.
Well, the very initial response was actually to crack down. So when they first went and they were surrounding the government offices, at the end of the student strike, which took place last week, the police cracked down. They shot tear gas, pepper spray. They batoned a lot of students. And the reaction to this was very sympathetic towards the protesters. And so it really, this repression really backfired on the government. Since then, They've clearly had a change in tack, and they've just been trying to wait it out, and they're letting the protesters occupy these spaces. The police have been on the scene, but have not been violent. But now this new development adds something sort of volatile to the mix.
We're talking with Eli Friedman. He's a professor at Cornell University. We're talking about the situation in Hong Kong. You can join us at 244-1777, toll-free 877-291-8255. The strategy then seemed to become that the hope was that other people in Hong Kong would get mad at the protesters. What happened when that strategy was attempted?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's been the strategy now for about a week, which is to say, well, let's just let them occupy these public spaces. They will inevitably cause disruptions to the normal functioning of the city. And then other people who are just trying to go to work or go to school or run their businesses will get upset with the occupiers. This will create internal divisions and things will split apart. You know, to be honest, there's some signs now that strategy has been somewhat successful. So I think it's the question is now, what can the protesters do to regain the upper hand, to continue to escalate against the government while themselves remaining peaceful?
Mm-hmm. So what are the options here?
Well, one thing that some protesters have threatened to do is to occupy government buildings. So right now they've been outside on the streets, and if they actually went into the buildings to more directly obstruct government business, then that would be a possibility.
Mm-hmm. Who's calling the shots? Is it the leadership in Hong Kong, or is it really Beijing? Who's calling the shots?
Oh, Beijing is absolutely calling the shots. So the chief executive, Xi Weilong, is... you know, certain day-to-day operations certainly are within his control. But in terms of the large strategy, I mean, this is a big, big deal for China as a whole. And so you can bet that President Xi Jinping and other people in the Communist Party leadership in Beijing are paying very, very close attention to this.
Then why hasn't there been a continuation of the crackdown? You would think that if Beijing was calling the shots, that would be the approach.
Well, perhaps, but I'm not sure that from their perspective it would be the most strategic thing because, again, there was that initial round of repression and the response to it was overwhelming support for the protesters. And after the police used violence against the protesters, the following day, you know, the crowds really grew in size. Grew in intensity, and also in terms of international pressure. If they just kind of let the protests peter out, then you're not going to have condemnations from you know, the U.S. or Britain or from the United Nations or whatever. If they use repression, if they use police violence, or if they bring in the military, which is, you know, you can never rule that out, that would obviously create other kinds of pressures on Beijing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wonder, though, if something happened on the mainland, if something happened in Tiananmen Square again, if they'd take this sort of Hong Kong approach.
Probably not. You know, the mainland is a different thing altogether. Hong Kong has had a lot more space for the development of civil society, and so groups can openly organize. There's better protections, much better protections for freedom of speech, freedom of media. Now, some people feel that those rights have been undermined recently, and there have been a number of violent attacks on people in the media who have been critical of Beijing. So there's some suggestion that these rights are being eroded. But the situation on the mainland is very different. Any hint of collective organization, collective action, will certainly face intense repression very quickly. And so it would never get to a situation where you have tens of thousands of people in the street, or Beijing would do everything in their power to prevent that from happening.
What's the maximum number that there have been in Hong Kong?
You know, it's hard to estimate. On July 1st of this year, there was a major protest, and going back to 2003, July 1st has been a day of protest in Hong Kong, and that marks the day that Hong Kong returned to Chinese rule from British rule. So this year, the protest was quite large because of all of this stuff about elections, which has been in the pipeline. So there were certainly more than 100,000 people that protested on that day. And it's been very difficult to get accurate readings of the numbers because you have these four occupations which are dispersed, and then you have little marches and then people moving about the city. But, you know, it's safe to say that there are many tens of thousands of people on the streets.
Mm-hmm. And back on the mainland, there's an effort to try to keep this news away from people on the Internet. I mean, is that even remotely successful?
You know, it's successful in the sense that they don't make it easy for people to find accurate information about what's going on in Hong Kong. And so you can go online and see that the Chinese censorship machine has really been kicked into high gear over the past week plus to try to scrub information about Hong Kong. But you're right, it's never perfect. And so people who want to get information, who are willing to make a little bit more of an extra effort to get over the so-called Great Firewall, certainly can, and they can get good information. But that's going to be a relatively small number of people. The average person is probably just going to go online and then see what they see, and if they don't see anything, then, you know, then they'll give up. So I think it's not totally effective, but it does have some effect.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Eli Friedman of Cornell University about Hong Kong. Is it fair to say that the big concern of Beijing is that this somehow backspreads to the mainland and creates some sort of political dissent back in China, or is that just too simplistic a view?
No, that's absolutely their concern. And if you look at some of the underlying causes for the protests in Hong Kong, it's not difficult to figure out why China might be concerned about that. So, you know, Hong Kong has a system with this really extreme inequality where you have a political system that is dominated by a small number of economic and political elites, and that normal people don't have any voice in politics. They don't have any mechanism to try to address this really stark inequality. And in broad outlines, that's precisely the same situation that you have in mainland China. So I think that they have a lot of reasons for concern. Another issue is that if you look at the sort of the so-called periphery of China, so places that include Hong Kong as well as Macau, which is the former Portuguese colony that's right next to Hong Kong, mm-hmm. If you look at Taiwan, or if you look at the western border, Xinjiang province, where there's been a lot of unrest among the Uyghur ethnic minority there, or certainly Tibet, which has been an issue for many years, of course. All of these places are quite restive at the moment, and the government in Beijing is concerned that if they blink on Hong Kong, if they give Hong Kong some more autonomy, that all of these other places are going to leave the fold and that China will essentially disintegrate as a result of that. Now, I think that this is unreasonable. I don't think that that is an accurate reflection of reality, but that is absolutely their fear.
Let's go to Cabot. Tony, good morning.
Good morning. I have a couple of questions. Maybe I can fold them into one here. Your guest earlier talked about the nature of the political process there in Hong Kong with the issue of control. And so my first question is, how is that different than what goes on here? And the second question is, just a few moments ago, your guest talked about, again, the economically elite folks being in control, and I have the same question again. How is it different from what's going on here? So I see this parallelism, and I'm hoping your guest can tease out some of the differences for me.
Well, the interesting thing, too, is that Eli wrote this piece where he compared the two Occupy movements.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, so you're right on point here.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's one of the interesting things that there are important parallels to the U.S. And the thing that's underlying Occupy Wall Street and Occupy Central in Hong Kong that is similar is precisely as you said. I think people have this sense that unless you're someone who's extremely wealthy, that it's difficult for you to have a meaningful voice in politics. And I think Absolutely, that is similar in both places. I think the difference is that, at least formally speaking, in the U.S., anybody can be nominated to run for president, right? Now, of course, practically speaking, it has to go through this party nomination process, and, you know, chances are I'm not going to be nominated to run for president by either of the political parties. So there's a, the process is quite different, and it is less less explicitly controlled by the government than is the case in China. So I think really the only, you know, well, there's other differences, but for right now, one of the major differences is that people in Hong Kong recognize that the political system is totally unfair and wildly favors elites, whereas in the United States, I think there's somewhat less of a recognition of that.
I didn't know, though, until I read your piece that Britain didn't give the people of Hong Kong the free voting either.
Yeah, and I think that that's something that's really important to emphasize, because sometimes people will say, oh, you know, the Chinese government is taking away Hong Kong's democracy, or they're taking away Hong Kong's freedom. And Britain, it was never democratic under the British. And in fact, in the late 1960s, there was major anti-colonial protests and then riots against the British. So under the British, there was something called the Governor of Hong Kong, and he was directly appointed by the Queen. So they did have, again, these sort of freedom of speech, freedom of press. These things were better protected, as well as an independent legal system, which makes it quite different from mainland China. And I think that those things are important, and those things that need to be defended. But in terms of electoral democracy, the British were certainly no saints.
Okay, so we've been talking about the political system. Just take a moment here and tell me, since 1997, what's changed in terms of freedom of the press, freedom of speech, and that question of justice?
Yeah, I mean, I should say that the legal system seems to have held up pretty well. Occasionally you see these comments from Beijing saying, oh, you know, the judges need to be patriotic or something like that, which indicates some infringement on legal autonomy. Freedom of press, freedom of speech, and freedom of association are things which have been reasonably well protected in Hong Kong. And frequently what you see is groups that are focused on doing stuff within China will set up in Hong Kong, where they do have this greater freedom. But more recently, particularly with respect to freedom of the press, there have been some troubling developments. One case is of this guy, Jimmy Lai, who runs a newspaper, which has been quite critical of China. And recently the Hong Kong government has opened this corruption investigation into him, and which seems to be basically bogus. There was another incident with a renowned guy in the media who was attacked by people with knives. You know, it's not 100% clear that this is organized by Beijing, but, you know, it's also possible that it was. So there are indications that this freedom of the press faces certain kinds of threats.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think is going to happen here in the next 6 months?
Well, it's really difficult to predict, of course. You know, it's been pretty clear all along that Beijing is not interested in any sort of compromise around elections. That being said, I think a lot of times people are very pessimistic about the Communist Party changing course. And if you look at what's gone on in Hong Kong over the past 10 years or so, there have been a number of cases where Beijing has wanted to do something in Hong Kong, where people have protested against it, and where they've won. So I'll give you just two examples. In 2003, Beijing was trying to pass this anti-subversion law within Hong Kong. You had huge protests with hundreds of thousands of people, and they shelved it. The same thing happened in 2012. They wanted to pass this thing called moral and national education. It was a sort of education curriculum reform, which many students saw as an attempt to brainwash them into being sort of pro-China. So this group of students under the organization Scholarism protested. They engaged in civil disobedience, and they won. So they shelved that. So, you know, things can change, and I think it'll really be a question of, will it be possible for the movement to stay relatively unified, focused on this demand of genuine elections, and whether they will be able to escalate, which is to say to increase the pressure on the government, continue to create some kinds of political disruption while maintaining nonviolence and maintaining the support of Hong Kong society. And if they can do that, then I still don't see why they can't win.
Mm-hmm. Wow, what a great story. So next time, let's do the interview in studio here.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you can go back and visit your friends in East Montpelier.
I'll be up there next month.
Oh, all right. Seriously? Huh. All right, well, maybe we should chat about doing an update on this story, but we'll I'll be in contact with you.
Great.
Have a great weekend.
Thanks a lot, Mark.
Eli Friedman is an assistant professor of international and comparative labor. He teaches, those are some of the courses he teaches, assistant professor at Cornell University. We were talking about the protests happening in Hong Kong. All right, we're going to take a quick break here. When we come back, we'll talk with political analyst Eric Davis. We'll be back right in just a few moments.